Welcome to Missing and Not Forgotten, the official podcast of the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency. I'm Sean Everett, DPAA's Media Relations Chief and your host. Thank you for joining us. Now that we have our first episode under our belts, I want to tell you a little of what to expect as we move forward into this second episode and beyond. The podcast will come out monthly on the first Monday of every month. 9 episodes of every year will be divided into three-episode arcs. In each arc, we'll talk about a specific service member we've identified from World War II, the Korean and Cold Wars, and Vietnam. So there'll be one arc about a World War II service member, one about an identified Korean War or Cold War loss, and one about a Vietnam War identification. In the remaining 3 episodes of the year, we'll talk to someone from DPAA or one of our partners about the things they do for the agency to help us find, recover, identify, and return to their families those still missing. In this first 3-episode arc, we're talking about Army Captain Emil Capon, a Catholic chaplain and Medal of Honor recipient who died as a prisoner of war in North Korea during the Korean War and could not be identified once the war was over. He was accounted for March 2, 2021. In the second and third episodes of Chaplain Capon's story, we'll be talking with our scientists about how he was identified and to one of his family members about what his identification means to them. But in this first episode, I'll be talking to Dr. Dawn Berry. She is the chief of research for our Korean War efforts here at DPAA. Welcome, Dr. Berry. Thanks for coming on our podcast.
Thanks so much, Sean. Really glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, your history with DPA, with the Korean War.
I would love to. So I am a historian by training. I have a bit of an odd background. So I have an undergraduate degree in archaeology, a master's in anatomical history, and a PhD from Oxford University in military and diplomatic history. And a little over 10 years ago, someone I had known at Oxford let me know that there might be an opportunity to help work on identifying unknowns in the laboratory. And I thought that that was the neatest way to be able to use archaeology, my anatomical history background, and military history to help contribute to something bigger than myself. So I've been here for about 10 years. I started in the lab. I've worked in the Indo-Pacific Directorate, Partnerships and Innovations, and now I'm the branch chief of the Korea Cold War team.
Excellent. Excellent. And we're here over these 3 episodes to talk about Chaplain Emil Capon. You have a little bit of a history as far as he's concerned too, correct?
Absolutely. So when I was first hired in the agency, I was hired to work on European unknowns because I can speak a little bit of French, German, and Italian. But when the previous person who worked on North Korea left for another job, I was assigned to work on North Korea. And at the time, there was a colonel named Colonel Mike Gann, a Marine colonel, who had gone to Father Capon High School. And he came to my desk one day and he said, "Dawn, if you do one thing while you're here at the agency, you need to help identify Father Capon." And so that really drove our research in a lot of different ways. And I'll tell you a little bit more about the story of how that happened over the next few minutes, I think.
Awesome. Awesome. So before we dive into that, let's sort of back up from a little bit more macro view of DPA. What do historians do at the agency?
That's a great question. I would like to say, what do historians not do? Just kidding. there are 3 major things that historians do at the agency. So if you think of a Venn diagram of all the interesting things we do, one is communicate with family members. So we write the products and sit down with family members at family member updates and annual meetings. Also, when families come in, we often come speak to them a little bit about the history of their cases and things like that. We also are very involved in the operational piece of the work that the agency does. So we do investigations in the field and the paperwork and research that goes along with that. So investigation proposals and excavation proposals. And historians are an integral part of the investigation process in the field. So we accompany SREs, scientific recovery experts, and also military staff to do our investigations in country in South Korea. And then the other thing that people know a little bit less about is the role that we play in identification. So historians help with the shortlist for the identifications for the laboratory. And then every identification packet that goes out is also accompanied with a historical report, which is an analytical argument about why a set of remains could be a person, which is really important. So those are the major things that historians do in the agency.
You're right. That sounds like a lot. Tell me a little bit about Chaplain Capon's background and history, a little bit about his story.
Yeah, absolutely. So Father Emil Joseph Capon was born on April 20th, 1916, on a farm near Pilsen, Kansas. He was ordained as a Catholic priest in 1940 and entered the U.S. Army Chaplaincy School in Fort Devens, Massachusetts in August of 1944. He served in the Burma Theater during the Second World War and was among the first U.S. service members in Korea, landing in July 18th of 1950. Early on in his time in Korea, he was awarded a Bronze Star for saving a wounded soldier in the early phase of fighting. And in November of 1950, he was part of the Battle of Ulsan. He helped negotiate a surrender and saved numerous men from being shot, including Sergeant First Class Herbert Miller, whose ankle was shattered during the fighting. He and a number of other men were marched to one of the biggest and largest permanent POW camps along the Yalu River, Camp 5, otherwise known as Pyoktung. And his actions while he was there saved many other men at the camp. He died on May 23rd of 1951 at the camp hospital that some called the Death Hut. The other thing about him is I think so many people remembered him after the war, during the war, and at the POW camp. He was really instrumental in keeping everyone's spirits alive, but he also would sneak out late at night and try to find food for the service members who were in the camp. The survival rate at Camp 5 was only about 50% in the early stages of the people who were there. And so a number of people, as mentioned, said that it was really because of him that they lived. In the early 90s, around 93, he was named a servant of God by Pope John Paul. And then he received a Congressional Medal of Honor in 2013 at the 60th anniversary of the Korean War Armistice.
Chaplain Capon was identified as part of the Korean War Identification Project, but not quite as the agency knows it today. Tell me a little bit about the project and how the chaplain fits into it.
Yeah, so it's actually a really interesting story. So when I first started working on North Korea, KWIP, the Korean War Identification Project, was a little bit different than it is now. So it first started to work on the assemblage of remains that came back in the early 90s, which we call K208, which you'll probably hear a little bit more from Veronica and Kristen about. And then our punch bowl unknowns. So those were remains that either came back from South Korea or North Korea during the Korean War. Those were all done individually through disinterment packets. So historians would write an argument about why we should set or disinter a specific set of remains. And then we would work with forensic anthropologists and also odontologists to help put together a packet and an argument to disinter a single set of remains. And those were all dealt with by individual anthropologists in the laboratory rather than in the big project that it's currently under. And around 2015, there was a lot kind of going on. So K208 was one of the most successful programs in the laboratory, and we had been doing punch bowl disinterments for almost 15 years for the Korean unknowns. But what was happening was with Camp 5 remains in particular, and that's where Father Capon was buried, we were having some issues with identification. So we were putting in quite a robust packet with good shortlists, and the shortlists are a laboratory and historians' analysis of who a set of remains could possibly be. And a lot of the times they were on that list. But what happened was more and more of these unknowns, as we were working on identifying them, were not coming back as the individuals we first thought it was. And so a couple things happened. We had to sort of look back at the camp and what was happening at the camp historically and how those remains were buried and then how they came back to us. And then separately in the laboratory, older cases were then transferred to K208 for them to help reevaluate them. And when that happened, there was a set of remains that came back from Camp 5 that had multiple FRS sequences. So that means there was more than one individual when it looked like one individual. And so that told us that there was likely commingling from Camp 5, and it helped us kind of change our approach. So I'll pause there, Sean, if you want to ask any questions. I think I talked a lot.
No problem. Actually, one thing that some of our listeners may want to know that they may not be familiar with, tell us a little bit about what commingling is. I know that's a little bit more of a lab thing, but people may not know what that refers to.
Yeah, I think Veronica and Kristen will definitely do a better job of explaining it than I will. But when we think about an unknown, we usually think of it being a single individual, but an unknown can be as little as one person or as many as hundreds of people represented in a set of remains. So commingling is when there are multiple individuals that are together either in a disinterment or in a burial site. And that means there's more than one individual that could be identified from a specific accession. So when the lab gets remains, they accession them in, and often we think of it as one person, but what our research has shown is that it can be more than one person. Basically, gotcha. It just means that there's multiple individuals represented with one set of remains.
Right. Excellent. Okay. Chapman Campan was a little bit older than most people serving in the Korean War. Not, again, diving too far into what Veronica and Kristen will talk about in the next episode, but from a historian and a research standpoint, was there a way that made him stand out a little bit more?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So the lab had been working for a really long time, and so had a number of other individuals, to see if Father Campan might have been in the remains that came back from North Korea. And I'd like to take a step back just for a second and talk about sort of the difference between remains that came back from North Korea and the remains that came back from South Korea. So remains coming back from North Korea were part of something called Operation Glory, which was one of the largest remains exchanges in history. And so at the end of the Korean War, essentially, we, the United Nations forces, were meant to be able to go back into North Korea and recover our war dead from UNMC or United Nations military cemeteries, battlefields, and POW camps. And then North Korea and China were supposed to be able to go back into South Korea and recover their war dead. But because there were such concerns about that sort of reinitiating armed conflict, what they decided to do was Operation Glory, where North Korea and China would recover our war dead for us, and the United Nations would recover North Korean and Chinese war dead, and then we'd exchange them. And that exchange is called Operation Glory. So one of the biggest differences between South Korean remains and North Korean remains is, on the whole, we didn't recover North Korean remains ourselves. The Chinese and the North Koreans did. And what that means is we don't necessarily have as much visibility or fidelity on how those remains are recovered and how they came back to us. So when we start studying that, there's sort of a different story there. All of the remains that we were not able to identify right away. So remains were all sent from South Korea and North Korea to the Central Identification Unit at Kakura, Japan. And when things started to be processed, they put everything into IBM punch cards, which are really cool. I think some of your listeners will remember using them at different times in their life. But
essentially, I remember.
They put the biological profile of an individual onto punch cards, and then they'd also put the biological profile of an unknown set of remains that for a bunch of different reasons might have not been able to be identified right away. And then they would sort those and then do kind of detailed individual analysis on each set of remains. So the interesting thing about Father Campan is, because he was quite a bit older than most of the other service members, he was around 35. There are anthropological differences in younger remains and older remains that Veronica and Kristen will be able to tell you a little bit more about. But in the historical documentation on the X-Files, we should be able to see that the age estimation would be a little bit older. And so the lab had done a lot of work to try to see if there was a set of remains that really stood out that could have been Father Campan that we could have put forward as an individual disinterment. Unfortunately, that didn't really come through. And what we've learned over the course of doing Korean War disinterments over the past 15 years before the Korean War disinterment plan was implemented, was that there is really big discrepancies in the historical documentation of age and stature estimation. So how old someone was or how tall someone was from what's in the paperwork we have versus what current modern day forensic techniques would be. So the thought at the time was Father Capon might not be in this assemblage. And then what we did was sort of reevaluate all of the remains that came back from Camp 5. And if you like spreadsheets, it's a really interesting story.
I mean, there are definitely people out there who like spreadsheets. However, talking about spreadsheets, typically not quite as interesting most of the time. So is at this point, you the historians have done and the analysts, you all have done all the research to get to the point of disinterment. Is there any other parts that you all were involved in?
Yeah, well, I think there's sort of a shift that happens in how we approach North Korean remains around the time that I started working on some of the Op Glory losses from North Korea, because the way we'd approach things before would be a more individual set of remains. So as mentioned, we might sort through and look for someone who is particularly old, or if someone had really unique dentition, so if their teeth were really odd, or they had bridge work, or they were very tall or very short, those would be ways that scientifically the lab could help narrow down the losses. And the challenge with Camp 5, we haven't talked a lot about it, but it was the largest and first major permanent POW camp during the Korean War. It also had a large number of casualties because of the conditions to get to Camp 5. It was a really, most people were marching over the course of the winter. It was really, really difficult conditions. There's a number of really great books if people would like more resources on it. But between January and March of 1951, when the camp was established, there was a 50% survival rate. So there were really hundreds of individuals who passed away. So that made it very, very difficult for the lab to do shortlists. So what we have now is this interesting picture of challenges with remains that we were disinterring. We also now know that there's evidence of commingling, so multiple individuals in punchable unknowns. And so where does that kind of leave us with Camp 5? So what we did was look back at all of the remains we had disinterred from Camp 5, and then also start to do what I call roster analysis. So all of the remains that came back from North Korea in Op Glory were accompanied with a transfer roster, and it usually gave a location, a number, a name sometimes, and any material evidence that came along with the person. And when you look at it as a whole, what we noticed was the remains that came back from Camp 5 were alphabetical, which is a little bit strange. And then if you put all that information together and we looked at what I called location concurrence and name concurrence. So were the individuals who've been identified either historically at Kakura or contemporarily in our DPAA and JPAC laboratory, did they match the place that they were from, and did they match the name that they were from? And so for Camp 5, almost everyone was from the place that North Korea and China said that they were from, so Camp 5. There were some other POWs in the mix as well, but that can be explained. But the thing that was really interesting is because those remains came back alphabetically, there was about a 50-50 chance if they gave us the name that they'd actually be identified as that individual. So that was a really interesting pattern. What we also saw is if it came back with a name, so Father Capon's name was on a list of names that remains came back, but another person was identified. I believe his name was Ross with the set of remains that came back as Father Capon. So if the name was there, it's more likely that the individual would also be there, but just as a different set of remains. So after we went back through all 4,219 sets of remains that came back in Operation Glory, including those from Camp 5.
And that's so, a lot of remains.
It was a lot of remains, and it's a lot of spreadsheets. Yeah. to try to show the different patterns in each part of the roster. And again, in Camp 5, what we see is almost everyone who had been identified historically or in the lab was from Camp 5. The big challenge is that the list, the short list, is really long, and that there is a possibility of commingling because, as mentioned, there's a 50% survival rate between January and March of 1950. So that's a large number of individuals who could have been at the camp. So what we ended up doing was make an argument, and leadership was very supportive of this, to disinter all of the remains from North Korea that were remained in the punch bowl and all of the remains from South Korea. And that was known as the Korean War Disinterment Project. And I'll take a breath because I'm sure I need to answer some other questions about what I just said.
Well, actually, you know, that all brings together everything that you were talking about. I think the Korean War Disinterment Project, that is a sub project under the Korean War Identification Project?
Absolutely. So my colleague, Dr. Jim Rose, worked on South Korea. And one of the things when we were doing these individual disinterment memos, which were really, really a fantastic example of how important it is for the agency to work in an interdisciplinary way. So as mentioned, we'd have historians who would write a historical report. Sorry, a historical list. We'd have historians who would work on the historical background for a specific set of remains, and then they would provide a short list of individuals who could be associated with the POW camp, the battle, however we were going to approach that particular case. And then an anthropologist would narrow it down, or if the list was really long, an odontologist, a forensic dentist, would look at it first. So the ways that PNR, personnel and readiness, would help us approve this was to make sure that we had lines of evidence that could give us a more than likely chance that we'd be able to identify a set of remains. And there are a whole bunch of different ways that we could do that. So you'll probably hear more from Kristen and Veronica about chest radiograph matching. But if they had a radiograph on file, that was a bonus point for us to get our disinterment memos approved. Also, if they had FRS, so family reference samples, I think you're going to hear from Tim McMahon, who's going to talk about the importance of DNA. We don't necessarily have direct DNA for most people, but we have references from their families. So if we had a specific amount of coverage, so more than 50% of these different lines of evidence, and in the very beginning, that those lines of evidence also included historical documentation. The really great thing for Korea is we had about 90% coverage for FRS at the time we were working on the Korean War Disinterment Plan. And I think it was about 70% coverage for chest radiographs, for the chest radiograph matching. So overall, for all of the unknowns that were in the punch bowl from North and South Korea, we could kind of check those boxes from a scientific perspective. And then from a historic perspective, we had done quite a lot of work on South Korea, and Jim Rose has really led the charge on that for well over a decade. And then for North Korea, Dr. Mike Dolsky, who was working with someone named Ron Broward, who is a Korean War veteran for a long time, had done really fantastic work. And then I picked up on that after him. And so all those pieces together allowed us to sort of make the argument to disinter all of the remains from North and South Korea from the punch bowl. So that's the Korean War Disinterment Project, which eventually went under KWIP, or what became known as KWIP, which is pretty cool.
Absolutely. So you brought up a bunch of different names as you were going through all of that. Historians, you're not just sitting in a cubicle or doing a research in a library or at a computer by yourself. It really is a team effort.
Absolutely. And I think in some ways, to do this work effectively, you sort of have to learn what everyone else had done before you. So for North Korea, there had been so many people who had worked on punch bowl disinterment. So Debbie Zinni, who's currently the deputy lab director in our Hawaii office, she had done fantastic work on Korean War disinterments. As mentioned, Jim Rose, Dr. Mike Dolsky, Dr. Jim Rose as well. And they originally worked with someone named Ron Broward, who is a Korean War veteran and was really driven by his desire to help identify missing service members. The story that I've heard about him is that he still had shrapnel in his body from when he was in the war. And he was very, very passionate about what he did. And a lot of the data-driven work that we did was based on some original lists that he had done, helping to sort of figure out who had been identified at the time of the war. So he was really integral to our process. John Bird, Jenny Jin, there's so many people who are involved in this process. And now we have, again, like more than a decade worth of KWIP and / K208 projects, anthropologists, forensic anthropologists who have all helped with that process. But it really is sort of a team effort. The other thing that's really interesting, I did mention that I have an anatomical history background. I think in order to do this particular job properly, we had to really understand historically from a history of science perspective, what happened at Kakura. So how were remains processed? What did they do? When could have exchanges taken place? And then also back to Camp 5 where Father Capon was, what was sort of the geography, the physical spaces in which remains would have been buried, where was the medical hut or hospital where Father Capon passed away. And I think I mentioned that there were kind of different stories about what could have happened to him. And when I first came into the agency, there was a strong thought that he might have, where he was buried could have been washed away. And I think I mentioned, but I might not have, that I'm Canadian originally. And because he passed away in May, I thought it was very unusual or would have been very unlikely that he would have been passed away in the hospital and then been taken down to the water to be buried near the water, because in May, the water would have been probably rushing because it was the spring. So we can make these sort of really interesting arguments about why the commingling happened, because often people couldn't be buried in the winter. So we talked a little bit about commingling, but why would that happen at Camp 5? And then where is Father Capon? So he passed away at this medical hut or hospital, which is sort of on a hill quite far from the water. And we have lots and lots of witnesses to where he passed away and when. And so the question is sort of, where does the history and the science intersect? And I think that's sort of a really interesting intellectual question, but also when we can get answers to families, that's really where all of those things come together. And it's really brought home, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we didn't really get into this with you personally. Why is this job, and you know, whether it be Chaplain Capon or anyone else, why is it such a big deal to you?
So I mentioned I have a little bit of an interesting background. My stepfather was in the Air Force. My grandfather fought in the Second World War. He was Polish and escaped from a labor camp and joined the British 8th Army and fought in Monte Cassino and in North Africa during the Second World War. I always wanted to do something with my life that mattered. And I always get emotional when I talk about this, but what I often say and what I said in my citizenship interview, I was originally Canadian, and the work that I did on Korean War unknowns is really what drove me to get American citizenship. And it was really the families wanting to get answers for them was what drove me to get American citizenship. And in my citizenship interview, they asked me why I wanted to be American. And I just love what the agency does. I think the mission itself is so important. I think it really embodies the power of history and the importance of it. And also, I don't think there's much that we can do better with our life than help give someone their name back. It's not only important for the service member themselves, but I think people who are not necessarily involved in this mission don't see how important it is for the families. And it really is an intergenerational thing. If you don't know what happened to your father, that passes down to not knowing what happened to your grandfather, your uncle. It touches so many different people in so many ways, and I think can have such a profound impact when we can help get some of those answers.
Agreed. You know, I've been with the agency for about 5 years or so, but you know, I left for a little while because I had to retire from the military, and I came back as soon as I could, just for a number of the same reasons, that it's something that once it sort of gets into you, it's there forever, and it becomes very important. So I completely understand where you're coming from.
And I think that's the thing that from the outside, it might be hard for some people to see. Often people can say that some of these processes take a long time, and sometimes they do, but I've never worked in a place where people were so dedicated to the work that they do. And everybody has sort of a different approach, but I think we're all unified by a desire to try to bring our fallen service members home. And also it really does become sort of a life's vocation for many of us who work in the agency. It's amazing to see how dedicated people are, including yourself, Sean.
I appreciate that. Same with you and everybody else that I've had the opportunity to work with over the last 5 or 6 years. So, well, Dawn, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And I really appreciate all the background, not just on Chaplain Capon and the Korean War, but on sort of the process that historians and analysts go through, you know, to be able to get remains to the lab so that we can then do the identification. So thank you very much for that.
Yeah. And I don't know if I finished the story, but that Marine colonel who I told you about, he also retired. Oh, yeah. But when he retired, he got notification that Father Capon had been identified. And I think I mentioned that he said, if you do one thing while you're here, you have to help get Father Capon identified. So I only played a small part in that story, helping get the remains out of the ground. But we were both very, very emotional when he found out that Father Capon had been identified. And I think it's another great example of how dedicated people are and continue to be to the accounting mission. So thanks so much, Sean. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dawn. Thank you very much.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us as we tell the story of how Chaplain Emil Capon was recovered, identified, and returned to his family. In the next episode, I'll be speaking with Dr. Veronica Keyes and Kristen Groh about how DPAA scientists in our laboratory were able to use multiple lines of evidence to positively identify Chaplain Capon. I hope you'll join us on the next episode of Missing and Not Forgotten.